The Other Side podcast mission is to discuss important cultural and social issues relating to race, culture, gender, and equality.
Welcome. Thanks again for joining us for another episode of The Other Side podcast. And in partnership with the Columbus Dispatch editorial board, The Other Side is featuring a series of special podcast episodes called In Black and White. The series is devoted to discussing racism and its meaning. These episodes will run in conjunction with op-ed columns appearing in the newspaper and on dispatch.com. Dr. Terrence Dean and I will be interviewing scholars in relevant fields to try to answer some of the most important questions related to racism. And joining us today is Kyle Strickland, senior legal analyst at the Ohio State University Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity and the deputy director of race and democracy at the Roosevelt Institute. Kyle wrote an op-ed column for the Dispatch titled Achieving Racial Equity Requires Confronting Systems of Power. Kyle, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
It's our pleasure.
Yeah, we're very excited. I want to thank you again. We're excited to get your op-ed piece on racial equity here in Columbus. And, you know, I'm excited because it's a new dawn and a new day. I want to know what your thoughts are when you wrote this piece. Were you thinking about, you know, where our country would be in the next 4 years or even in the next 10 years or 20 years? When you talk about racial equity and how we confront systems of power.
Of course. So, you know, thanks so much for having me. You know, when I think about racial equity and racial justice, you know, I think about accountability. I think we are living in an accountability moment. I think we saw with the protests, the nationwide protests after the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, of Ahmaud Arbery, on a national reckoning that we've seen kind of a multiracial coalition come together to address these issues, especially around police violence, but even more broadly to see issues of systemic racism and tackling these issues and knowing that we have problems right here in our own backyard here in Columbus. And we've seen those instances of police killings happen right here. And what comes to mind is the need for accountability in this moment, because there's always this jump, and we're seeing it right now, of just, well, let's move to unity without actually talking about what accountability means. And so when we're talking about racial justice and racial equity, it isn't ignoring the issues that exist in our society and acting like everything's okay, or it's not sweeping those issues under the rug. It's actually bringing that into the center and making sure that we are speaking truth to power. We are telling the truth. And that's why I think right now, more than ever, it has to be an accountability moment. And we've got to reckon with the fact that we still have issues of racial inequality, racial injustice in this country. And those are the ugly truths that we've ignored for too long. And some, unfortunately, are still trying to ignore that. And I think this is a moment for all of us to say, we've got to bring that into the fold. That's what makes us a better country, and that will make us a better community to one another.
I'm glad you brought up the accountability part, because in your op-ed, there is a part where you say, beyond changing the minds and hearts from racial disparities, we have to address the structural barriers and systems that perpetuate the injustice. And this is what you're getting at. Even though people, you know, some of us are saying, yes, let's move toward unity, but we have not yet addressed the systemic, oppressive, marginalized barriers that can continue to perpetuate the injustices. So how do we continue? How do we move forward? And how do we address those issues systemically? What would you recommend?
So there's a couple things. So one, folks got to know the history of this country. You know, I think there's this narrative when it comes to racial progress in this country as if it has been inevitable to moving towards a more just, a more equitable society. And then as if, you know, you had slavery and segregation and Jim Crow, and then followed by the civil rights movement, Obama gets elected president, and then somehow we've achieved where we need to be. And what we need to really talk about are the impacts of systems and structures on perpetuating inequality. The facts are that a lot of people, when they think about racism, when they think about, you know, these issues around race, they might think about interpersonal reactions. They might understand when somebody uses a racial slur or does something that's discriminatory. And that's kind of the most that they'll see how deeply systemic or how racist things are. When in fact, We have to talk about all those racist policies, those racist laws that we saw in the past. Those have an impact where we are today. And so that is where there has been a disconnect of those who say, well, look, we've addressed some of those issues with the civil rights movement, so those don't exist anymore. And so as a result, we shouldn't talk about those issues. You're talking about race too much. And instead, we should talk about personal responsibility and hard work. And it really comes down to the individual. When we don't appreciate the level that structures and systems play at continuing to perpetuate inequality. So we have to talk about how it impacts housing, the economy, the criminal justice system, and that these disparities go beyond any one single individual. This is about institutions that continue to implement these sorts of policies and practices that hurt and harm Black and brown communities, as well as other communities that are marginalized.
Yeah, and you lay that out in the early part of your op-ed where you talk about COVID-19 and you talk about low-wage jobs and how those systemically impact Black and brown persons. So go a little more in depth about that, because when you lay it out in your op-ed, like, you know, COVID-19 has significantly impacted Black and brown communities. And now we have a second and third variant of this strain, and how that's going to significantly continue to impact Black and brown communities if they don't get the vaccine or have access to getting the vaccine. Low-wage jobs. We've seen recently that there's this a policy to increase the minimum wage across the country. And there are some who are protesting against increasing the minimum wage. Because I saw memes where people saying, well, I don't want someone who works at McDonald's who's flipping burgers to make as much money as me. Right. They don't want anyone poor to have at least the basic necessities to live life. Could you go into depth like how that comes up, as you're mentioning, systemically oppressive as racist?
Of course. So first off, you know, I think being very clear and specific about how our history ties into where we are today, in the sense that on every single indicator, we continue to see Black and Latinx communities, indigenous communities lagging behind their white counterparts. And there are those who hold racist ideologies and problematic ideologies that believe that, well, that is the result of culture, or that is the result of their own individual responsibilities, and not talking about how these systems have been put in place to systematically shut people out from opportunities. So when it comes to COVID-19, we've already known that Black and brown communities suffer disproportionate amount of health disparities than others. And that is the result of a whole host of issues, less access to quality health care. And even when they do have access to health care, facing discrimination. And we've got countless stories of Black people, especially Black women, facing discrimination within the healthcare system, not being taken seriously, thinking that somehow that they tolerate pain more than others. All these kind of racist ideologies that plague in these biases that then shut people out from additional opportunities. And then on top of all of that, we make it incredibly difficult for those who are living in poverty or those who are lower income. And because of our country's history around these punitive policies, what ends up happening is we have a social safety net that doesn't provide the security and certainly not the economic security that families need. And so what ends up happening is we tend to punish people if they live in poverty or if they're lower income. And so instead of giving people access to healthcare, we say that perhaps they're not deserving of these basic human rights and needs. And so what ends up happening is they have less access to these resources. They fall further into poverty. They face further health consequences, and it hurts us all. And we've ignored these issues for too long because we as a society think that perhaps one person is less deserving over the other, when instead we need to be having conversations about these are rights that should be guaranteed to every American, especially knowing we are one of the we're the richest country on earth and we can afford it. And the notion that we can't is deeply problematic.
So with that, and now that we are on the other side of a new administration, what do you think, or what are your hope or expectations from this new administration that they will address as far as some of these concerns and issues that plagued us for the last 4 years? And how do you think that some of that ties into your op-ed of, okay, we're talking about, you know, Joe Biden. I mean, I think he's done a brilliant job so far. His new administration is filled with women of color, people of color. Like, he's making a very diverse effort to be more inclusive. But will it take more than just putting people of color and faces of color in place and positions to do that necessary work?
Of course. So, you know, one, the fact that we have this type of representation in the White House and in federal government, and of course, with Kamala Harris as the first woman, first Black woman, first Asian woman as Vice President of the United States is incredible. And that representation matters. And that will make a tremendous difference in terms of what's possible in America. This is another story in this chapter of what's possible. And then to see people in positions of power, in positions of leadership that look like you and me and others will set the tone for what America is. It's a multiracial, multiethnic, multicultural democracy that we are striving to perfect, but is not yet there. But beyond all the representation, you need systemic, structural, transformative policy change. At the end of the day, we can no longer just expect that incremental reforms are going to get us to where we need to be. If you really believe in achieving racial justice, if you believe in addressing systemic racism and systemic inequalities that we see in our country, especially as it relates to income inequality, the racial wealth gap, all these issues, then you're going to need some transformative solutions here. The fact is that there has been this, what I would say, and a lot of other scholars have talked about, which is this kind of neoliberal approach to our economy and to our policymaking. And this is idea that you can kind of, you know, work on the edges incrementally and kind of leave government out of it and let the markets take care of business. This is the whole trickle-down economics that we've talked about. Well, that strategy has failed. And honestly, many folks would say it succeeded because what it did was give more money to those at the very top, the wealthiest and corporations, and then it gutted quality healthcare and social services for everyday people. And we saw this happen even over the past 4 years to see what happens when you have a government that is not actively trying to help and support people, but instead has policies that are punitive and says, well, we'll let the market take care of it. We need to make sure that we can show that a government can deliver for people. The facts are that we, both progressives and conservatives, have now over the past, you know, four decades, have looked at government as a way of a tool that has gotten in the way of our problems, when instead it needs to be used as a solution because it has the capacity to do so. You can implement transformative changes through our government to make sure that we are having a government that can actually reduce some of the suffering that we're seeing. We know right now how problematic it is when you have a government that botches a response as it relates to the COVID-19 pandemic. And the facts are that we can do much better, but we need policies and structural reforms. And here's the thing, that's going to cost money. And we need to realize that to address some of these issues that we have in our society, we're going to have to spend some money on these issues. And that's the way we transform our systems and our institutions. And that is the right thing for us to do. And we can afford it.
With that in mind, the work that you're doing with the Roosevelt Institute, how does that play a part of what you all are hoping to see, just transformative work here in the greater Columbus area?
Of course. So the work that I just started at the Roosevelt Institute, and they are headquartered in New York. And I am based here in Columbus, working remotely. But that work is connected with the FDR Library and kind of a nonprofit partner as a think tank. And we work really on the economy and democracy and ways in which we can implement policies in a worldview that shows and showcases that everybody has the dignity and opportunity to thrive. And until the rules are working for everybody, they're not working. And so a lot of the focus on the work that I do right now is around race and democracy. And it's a lot of national level work of thinking through the types of changes that we need to do to ensure that racial justice, racial equity is centered not only in our federal policies, but locally at the state level. And this has to go through government, through the private sector, through our institutions, all across the board. And then I continue to be the senior legal analyst at the Kerwin Institute right here in Columbus, Ohio, at Ohio State. And that work really is about how do we take that research and apply it every single day, knowing that we have to learn how to talk about race. Not everybody is ready to talk about race. We have to make sure that people are comfortable with being uncomfortable. You have to talk about how these issues persist. And you also have to talk about how things like redlining, and I know a lot of this series have talked about these, have continued to permeate the racism in our neighborhoods, within our schools, within our institutions that we continue to see today. And so we work with community partners and marry that with research, grounded in evidence and research. I mean, the facts are that some people like to dismiss the disparities, the inequality we see today by maybe talking about their own anecdotal experiences, saying, well, so-and-so was able to succeed and they were in poverty or they're black, so why can't more people be like so-and-so? I know we've all heard that, right? So they talk about one or two stories of success to say, well, the American dream is alive and well, and anyone who's not meeting it just isn't working hard enough. And yet they don't look at the systematic oppression and inequality that we continue to see. And that's grounded in research. That's grounded in facts, in truth. And that's the other thing right now. We are seeing an assault on truth right now. We have to speak truth to power. We cannot allow misinformation and disinformation to continue to thrive in this society. That doesn't help anybody.
So as by trade, you are a lawyer. So yeah. I want to know the work that you do and judiciously, how and what that looks like for people of color, the system, the judicial system, but also now that we're talking about police reform and, you know, the mayor has been proactive around this new initiative. Is it feasible or ideal or ideological for Black people to be very hopeful around this new idea of police reform and the Community Action Review Board?
So, you know, I think there are some I think there are some signs of opportunity for progress and change. You know, as I mentioned at the beginning, this is an accountability moment. And so any steps toward that need to be met with, you know, scrutiny, but also understanding that there are some reasons to hope. With that said, I completely understand why some people aren't hopeful. And it's not my job to say that they should be because, you know, we need action. You know, I think that's been a big problem that we see is that, you know, we hear a lot of words and a lot of process and a lot of steps in the, you know, we would hope right direction. And then it seems like we take two or three steps back from things that happen and incidences that happen. And the other thing that I think is important is that, you know, a civilian review board, which is critical and is a necessary step when it comes to police accountability, transparency more broadly, is not going to solve all the problems that we continue to face. And so that's why we have to talk about wholesale structural reform and transformative reform in these issues, understanding that we also have to talk about policing practices. We also have to talk about kind of reimagining what we think community safety is really all about. And understanding that why do we even have some of these problems in the first place? Some of the roots of these issues that continue to persist. A lot of that racial justice, those racial justice issues tie in to economic justice and need to make sure that people have the support that they need, but also ties into just the basic dignity and ability for people to thrive in this society. We have to do better. And so we can't think one or two reforms is going to get us there. And so this is a step in the right direction. But here's the thing. People have been calling for this for a really long time. And so I get why some people might be frustrated because they say, well, why couldn't we do this sooner? And so now here we are. This is what we have to work with. But we have to be very clear that we have a long way to go. There's much more work to be done.
Are you hopeful also as well with the Kerwin Institute that some of that work that you all are doing will tie in to what the goal of the city is looking to accomplish as far as addressing those issues of racial and democracy, as well as economics equity?
So I am. I think, you know, if I were not, I don't think I'd be working there because, you know, at the end of the day, I think we all have to kind of look in the mirror and think about ways in which we are either contributing to a status quo or we are implementing or being part of something that is creating transformative change. And, you know, I'm not, it's not lost on me that any one position or any one individual is going to be able to make the system, you know, systematic impacts that we need to make in this society. We're going to get there overnight. But what I will say is that if I can wake up every day knowing that the types of issues that I'm working on can have an impact on everyday lives and can have an impact on changing the broader narrative, then I'm hopeful. But at the same time, you know, that hope is also met with an understanding of the reality of where we are, and know that change doesn't happen overnight. Yet it is up to people from wherever they operate in the system or in the society to demand change happen right now, because it's too late. And so, look, you know, I have the benefit of not being in a position where, you know, I have to make these decisions, and ultimately at the end of the day, you have to implement and figure out ways in which it works. But I think those who are on the outside, even those who are within the system, need to push further. And you know, one of the direct ties to this that I think can resonate with a lot of people is, you know, we had Martin Luther King Day earlier, and a lot of folks were quoting King. A lot of folks were talking about all the great quotes that King has said. And yet, not a lot of people have been really heeding to the words of King talking about racial justice and economic justice and the need for genuine equality. He even talked back then about the facts that a lot of the struggles for the civil rights movement was a struggle for just basic decency and a recognition of humanity. But even the rights that were won were rights that we should have already had. And so we got these at bargaining rates. And so he talked about it's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee an income for everyday people, because there's continuing to be the types of pushback that we see. And so what I would argue is that when we think about King, when we think about advocates for racial justice, we think if we were back in the civil rights movement, all of the things that we would have done, I would say we are in that moment now. And you have to ask yourself, do you continue to believe that the way you are going about doing things is the right way of doing it? And I think we should all say, no, we have to do more. We have to be more transformative, and we cannot stop at believing, well, we can't do that because that's too much or that's inconvenient. No, the fact is it's a tremendous privilege for us to be in a position and say, well, let's maybe wait for another time, or let's maybe work slowly on these issues and not get the transformative change that we need to happen. We need change right now because people are suffering. And so long as people are hurting, we have to do everything that we can to make that change happen. And so I'm hopeful, but I know we have a lot more work to do. And we got to do this work together.
I'm glad you brought up King and acknowledging that his work around labor, because that is ultimately when he was in Memphis, when he was killed. He was there for the labor rights for Black men and women who were there fighting. And then ironically, King did not want to go to Memphis. He was, you know, but he went down there and was fighting for the injustice that was happening economically. So I'm glad that you brought that up and tied that in, because people think of King and they think of race, but when he got on the other side of racial and economic justice is where we see that he is later killed. So I want to know, you know, and we hopefully tie this up. Again, getting back to low wage and wage economics, economic disparity here in the Columbus area. What do we begin, or how do we make change? Is there a way for us to move forward and press the government or the state to look at ways to make it more equitable for people who are suffering to meet the bare minimums? And I think we're not, when we talk about economic disparity, I think people just think of, oh, just give them better jobs or finding jobs that are equitable. But equity and economics tie also into health, as you mentioned. If you cannot afford health care because you have a low-paying job, or food deserts, or schools, and how that play a huge part. Where you live, community, because you pay taxes. So that's why whatever you pay in your taxes goes towards that particular area, and how that impacts education. So all of those play a huge part. So I think people are not making those connections. And I want you, if you can just make that simple one-line connection for us around economic justice and how that can help a community that is suffering.
Of course. So one, we've got to address the racial wealth gap and the wealth gap more generally, the continuing and growing wealth and income gap with the richest Americans and everybody else that has continued on. So, you know, there's a lot of different levers that folks have to play at a federal and state and local levels. You know, first and foremost, we need to raise the wage, the minimum wage. I mean, period. That needs to happen. The facts are that the fact that that has not happened and folks continue to buy into this rhetoric of, well, you know, I don't want so and so making more money because I don't think it's deserving of making $15 an hour. First of all, that doesn't even take into context how much the affordability of things. I mean, we are in an affordability crisis as well. The cost of everything else has gone up. And so even a minimum wage job, even a $15 an hour job, you're still going to be struggling to make ends meet. Look, think about the cost of living. Think about all the different costs, healthcare costs, all these costs that go into these issues mean that we need to be doing more to provide support for those who are struggling. And you raise the wage, it helps the floor. We know this. And so do not buy into these arguments that we shouldn't raise the wage because it's going to hurt job creation. No, that's not going to happen. Instead, we're actually going to pay people a living wage and treat them with the dignity that they deserve. And beyond just raising a wage and living wage, we also have to strengthen the social safety net. A lot of that has to be done through the federal level because they've got the levers and capacity to do so. However, there are other aspects and ways that the state level and even some aspects at the local level where you can actually make sure that we're doing what we can to ease the burdens of some of these issues that we see. You know, cities can address smaller things about, you know, fines and fees that continue to hurt Black and brown, lower income communities that are so hit and hurt with fines and fees that fall further and further into debt and continue to struggle. There's a lot of policy changes that we can implement. And even at a pilot basis, we should look at. So here in the city of Columbus, we should look at piloting a guaranteed income program and ensuring that regardless of a background, regardless of whether you have a job or not, we want to provide a reasonable stipend that you can have every month to make sure you're able to help ends meet. Those are the types of things we have to be innovative and creative. And I understand that a lot of these policy changes that we might implement locally here in Columbus are often preempted by a state legislature that seems to be more interested in arguing about divisive issues that have no bounds in what everyday Ohioans are actually concerned about. And so we see instead of state legislatures that doing more to help and support people, we are unfortunately seeing a legislature that is continuing to harm people. And that's because we have to be honest that this isn't just some sort of both sidesism argument here. We have to be clear about the fact that the right wing has been very specific and targeted on ensuring that truth telling and all these things that we're talking about, a lot of folks aren't talking about systemic racism. They're not talking about white supremacy. They're not talking about economic injustice. They're saying that everybody can make it. Just look at the job creators at the top and that wealth will work its way around. We've got to do more to address these issues. And most Americans, most Ohioans agree with that. And, you know, and I would say reasonable politicians on every side of the aisle should agree with the fact that the income inequality we continue to see. We just have to get there and work in that direction. So there's a lot of steps that we can take, and I'm confident that we'll move in the direction at the federal level, and we'll see what happens at the state level. But we need to focus on economic equality and tackling racial injustice.
Thank you so much, Kyle. We really appreciate you joining us here on the other side. You know, the way you speak, I'm listening to you. I said, this brother needs to be in politics.
We'll see, man.
Right. But I really thank you and appreciate you taking your time for this. And folks can definitely check out your op-ed piece simultaneously with this podcast. So thank you again for sharing your thoughts and insights with us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Look, you know, at the end of the day, I think there will be people who try to talk about the moment we're in and say, well, you talk about injustice or speaking truth to power. Well, that's being divisive. What I would argue is this, you know, if we continue to ignore the challenges and the suffering and the pain that people are facing and acting as if it's inevitable and acting as if there's nothing we can do about it or it costs too much, and yet we continue to give tax breaks and tax cuts to the richest Americans, that's not justice. we can create a society where it's not punitive against other people, but also supportive and helping other people, especially Black people who have continued to be marginalized in this country, lower income people. We can do that. That is a good thing for us to do. That shouldn't be a political thing. That should be an issue of human rights. And so I'm just grateful, and hopefully people can continue to call for justice. Thanks.
All right. Well, look at you. Look at Senator Kyle Strickland.
Appreciate it, man.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Thanks, take care. Kyle.